Okay, the next case is combined, number 14-1778, South Alabama Medical Science against Nurses, and 14-1779, Merck & Company against Nurses. Mr. Parther.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Thomas Parker, and I represent the appellant, South Alabama Medical Science Foundation, also referred to as SAMHSF in our briefs. The patents at issue include, there are three patents, the 778, 915, and 381 patent. Your Honors, this morning we respectfully ask that the Board's obvious determination be overturned because the Board committed at least three legal errors. First, it failed to expressly articulate whether a person of ordinary skill in the art at the time of the invention would have had a reasonable expectation of success in combining surf and seam, Emarasa. Second, the Board in finding that the prior art did not teach against serpentine Emarasa, and the Board compounded this error by ignoring data in certain of these prior art references. And third, the Board applied an erroneous legal standard in rejecting SAMHSF's objective evidence. Your Honor, with respect
I'll ask you the same question I asked the earlier counsel. If you had to pick your strongest argument, what would you pick?
That the Board failed to expressly articulate a reasonable expectation of success analysis in support of their obviousness determination. Your Honor, even if all the limitations were met by the prior art in which the Board combined, and even under those circumstances, KSR, as well as this Court's precedent, requires that in an obviousness determination that a reasonable expectation of success analysis be conveyed, especially in connection with cases that are complex or where the technology is unpredictable. There's no dispute with respect to the complexity and unpredictability of the subject matter of this case. In fact, both experts have agreed and testified that they were complex. And under those circumstances, there is no analysis that is provided. And even if it's somehow implicit or indirect in the Board's opinion, which we say it is not, which Gnosis agrees that there's no explicit analysis provided, that still is not enough. Because this Court's precedent also makes clear, as well as KSR, that the obviousness analysis must be explicit. It must set forth those particular grounds and reasons for finding the claims obvious. So if the Board were to conduct a reasonable expectation of success analysis, the question would have been, would a person of ordinary skill in the art in combining serpentine and Emarasa, would they have a reasonable expectation, for example, to be able to treat vascular disease, which is a claim element in the 778 patent, by lowering that individual's homocysteine level? And the reason why I include homocysteine levels is because serpentine, the reference, the main reference by the Board relied on, requires that the serpentine reference is strictly directed to lowering homocysteine, and there's nothing in serpentine which expresses treating any other condition independently of lowering homocysteine. And so the Board was not enabled to, at least when they were combining it, they mentioned there was a common purpose with respect to folate deficiency. But that's not what serpentine is. It is a reference that teaches lowering homocysteine and requires it. It's a requirement of serpentine. So that would have to be built into the RES analysis, reasonable expectation of success. And that wasn't done. To the extent that was not done, then so the Board, so to Your Honor, Judge Plager's comment, that would be the one defense that we would most likely win on. Now, I just want to just touch on other aspects of the case teaching away. There are a series of references, Harpy 1 and Harpy 2, for example, which contain live data showing that if one were to administer what I refer to the 5-MTHF, which is a racemic version of 5-methyltetrahydrofolic acid, and its natural isomer, which I would refer to as L5, actually shows when you administer L5 to a patient who is unable to make L5, homocysteine levels are not decreased. They're actually increased. They actually go up, which is contrary to Serpentine, which Serpentine requires it to go down. And that data was ignored by the board in this situation. The board acknowledges the existence of Harpy 1 and Harpy 2 references with respect to stability, but did not take any consideration, or at least does not appear to incorporate that or take it into account in its analysis. And then there's another series of references, which we refer to as Horn, sometimes referred to Wagner. And we apply the Horn reference together with what's referred to as the Euler reference. These two references are very significant because they also teach away. They teach against. I mean, Harpy 1 and Harpy 2 would teach against combining Serpentine and Marazzo, as would Horn and Wagner, for the reasons discussed in our papers, but just briefly. In order for the natural isomer L5 to be biologically active and to be retained in the cells for purposes of metabolism, it has to be polyglutamated. And what Horn shows is that when L5 is administered, it is not polyglutamated. And how do we know that? Because it's not metabolized. Because Horn shows that it states in the reference that it's not significantly metabolized. Now, where the board went wrong with respect to the Horn reference is that it relied on a particular aspect. Because in our papers, we were saying that L5 is a poor substrate for polyglutamation, and as a result, it is it's poorly retained and it's not able to function. But the board now, when the board looked at the Horn reference, it said, well, look, it says here on A2073 in the second column, it says that 5-methyl is concentrated by the hepatocytes, the cells in the case. Thus, there are two mechanisms by which liver may retain folates. But the problem there is that the board wrongly assumed that what was being concentrated there was functional L5, a functional folate. The reference Horn makes clear that it is not significantly metabolized. In fact, their expert, Nosa's expert, even testified to the effect that he acknowledged that 5-MTHF is a poor substrate for polyglutamation. And as a result, there is a decrease, or there is no formation of functional folate. So the cells actually become deficient in functional folate. So it's not able to metabolize. If it's not being metabolized, then the whole process of converting homocysteine to methionine is not going to take place.
But they did agree it was a metabolite.
Who did?
L5.
L5 in its form, when you ingest folic acid and you go through all the cycles, there's going to be a formation naturally in the cells of L5.
Yes.
And that'll be polyglutamated through the whole process, and then it'll be converted into, it'll donate the methyl group to convert homocysteine to methionine, correct. But what the board didn't appreciate was the fact that Horn did not contradict Dr. Gregory's testimony or his opinions. In fact, Horn supported it. So it was a misinterpretation of the reference, because there's nothing in this reference suggesting that any of the material that was concentrated in the cells was actually a functional form of folate. And it actually supported the opinions of Dr. Gregory that directly administered 5L5 and 5-MTHF are poor substrates for polyglutamation. And therefore, they're not biologically active, and without that, they're not retained in the cells. So all the while, when we're referring to accumulated L5 in the cells, we're referring to functional L5, because it would not make any sense to be relying on Horn for a proposition that we were looking to Horn to show the accumulation of non-functional folate. So that's where the board erred in that respect. And then we have also the board rejected Dr. Miller's testimony when he described and he conceded this whole notion about directly administered 5-MTHF in this particular case would not be a poor substrate for polyglutamation and therefore would not be able to form functional folate. The board rejected that testimony on the grounds that the deposition testimony itself was really directed to his statement as of the day the deposition was taking place, which was May 6, 2013. But that was incorrect, because if you look at the transcript, the predicate, the foundation of the time frame was clearly set out from The time period of 1995 to 1996, he was handed an exhibit. The exhibit and the line of questioning dealt with folic acid, and it continued. So it's clear that the time frame was established, and that he was testifying not as of May 6, 2013, but of one of ordinary skill in the art prior to the 95-96 time frame. So the board erred there as well, and as such, with respect to the proposition that Horn, together with Ewan, taught against combining serpentina metabolism, the board either ignored or the board misapprehended the evidence that was submitted. Okay, now with respect to secondary considerations, the board rejected all of SAMHSA's objective evidence. And for various reasons. First, the board took the position that we failed to tie in this particular case, the secondary considerations, for example, commercial success was based upon the sales of products that were sold by a company called Pamlin. The board took the position that we did not tie the components of the products to any particular claim elements to tie into the commercial success.
What was their reason for saying there was no tie? They were not willing to accept what you proffered, I assume, that it is the product itself
right.
that is sold?
Well, the problem was the board used the word novel element in the claim. We failed to tie the evidence to a novel element in the claim.
Yeah.
There is no individual novel element. What we have is a novel combination of elements that were known in the prior art. And so that was the problem with the board's rationale. We in fact, tied the evidence, which is the products are a combination of vitamins, and we tied the elements, which the claim is directed to, it directs to reduce folate in one or more vitamins, and we tied all that together in the form of six declarations by six experts. And so the notion of tying it to a novel element just doesn't work when you have a novel combination of prior art elements. So that was one of the reasons, one of the grounds, and that was a mistake on the part of the board. Also, the board seemed to be requiring that the claims have to explicitly recite the specific vitamins, the vitamin combinations or the specific ingredients exactly as they appear in the product. When in fact, that is not a requirement. I mean, the claims are certainly broader than the products, and that's fine. In fact, under this court's precedent, that seems to be the case when you're introducing objective evidence. You don't have to show objective evidence for every conceivable embodiment under the scope of the claim. In another aspect as well, the board rejected the evidence requiring SAMHSA to show evidence that other embodiments within the scope of the claim would have behaved the same as the PAMLAB products. That we had to provide evidence showing that they would have, other undefined embodiments would have behaved the same as each of the five PAMLAB products that we were working with. And that is not a requirement under any of the case law, at least that I'm aware of. And what the board did, to put it all together, is there were references to the word unique with respect to some of our witnesses' statements in the declarations. But this word unique was, the board took the word unique to say, well, you are implying that the combinations of the specific vitamins used in the PAMLAB products are so unique that no other embodiment within the scope of the claim would behave the same as these products. Well, that's just not a reasonable interpretation of the testimony, and I think it speaks for itself. And for example, he cites to Mr. Ladner, who was a senior vice president of PAMLAB, and when he was referring to the word unique, he was just making a comparison to the market in terms of conventional drugs, which are usually chemical entities, versus what we have here is what's referred to as medical foods, vitamins, which are exempt from the Hatch-Waxman Act. So the word unique does not at all justify the sweeping conclusion by the board that somehow these statements by themselves would stand for a proposition that every conceivable embodiment under the scope of the claims would not behave the same as the PAMLAB products. So in that regard, the board rejected all of CMSAT's objective evidence. And we believe that that, that was error, that is not the, does not follow this court's precedent. In fact, it just required a way much too stringent, it imposed a much too rigorous requirement for establishing the nexus with respect to the commercial success, the licensing, the copying, the industry praise, the long-felt need. I mean, there's an abundance amount of objective evidence that we submitted to each of these five products. I mean, this case is a little bit atypical. We have five different products.
What's our standard of review for all of those underlying facts coming from the board?
So the standard review would be substantial evidence for the factual findings. Obviously, legal conclusion of obviousness would be
This whole case is based on an accumulation of a variety of factual determinations, is it not?
No, I mean, the underlying case, surely. But the gist
to which we have to give deference under the most deferential standard
right.
that exists,
right.
which is if there's substantial evidence in that record,
right.
we're bound.
Right.
But you agree with that?
I agree that that is the, you're absolutely correct, that is the standard. But what we're saying here is the board applied the wrong legal standard to the facts.
What we were just talking about factual issues. What's the wrong legal standard?
The wrong legal standard, requiring that a claim has to recite the specific embodiment exactly. That is not the requirement for establishing nexus. That the products have to behave the same across the board of the range of the claim. That is not a legal, that is not a requirement under this court's precedent.
You're getting all this from your interpretation of the board's explanation of what it did.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's quite apparent from the board. Because they also cite the case of In Re Co, and they focus on the section of In Re Co dealing with unexpected results. Now, unexpected results has a little bit, it does have an obligation to show that you have to show the unexpected results across the range of the claim. But that's not so, for example, for commercial success. And there are a number of cases that this from this court which says that you don't have to show commercial success for each and every embodiment under the scope of the claim. So that's what we're essentially saying, Your Honor, is that they did not properly apply the precedent of this court as we laid out in our papers.
So if they were a little more careful in how they'd written it, you wouldn't be up here.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. If they were to follow this court's precedent,
even with the same result, since it's all fact based.
Excuse me, one more.
Even if they reach the same result, which is all fact-based,
right.
had they written it more carefully, you wouldn't be up here.
Well, I would like to think not. I mean, if they applied the case law correctly, I would like to think they would have come to the conclusion that the claims were not obvious, or that they would have given due weight, significant weight, to the evidence of commercial, to the objective evidence.
Well, they're required to consider the objective evidence, the secondary considerations, as a matter of law.
That is correct.
Are they not?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And just another example as well is we provided evidence of industry praise, and it was rejected because the court found that it was not tied, that it was tied to just the L5 and not the combination, and said, well, the L5 is a prior art element. I mean, that is a situation where perhaps maybe a factual issue, but when you read the declarations, as we cite in our papers, it's just not the case. The experts clearly associate the industry praise with the invention, claimed invention as a whole, not with respect to one vitamin. Now I reserve 3 minutes of time.
Well, are the issues any different between the university and Merck? Perhaps it would make more sense to continue with your argument in chief and with your rebuttal in chief.
Yes, Your Honor, there are overlapping.
Are issues different?
There are some issues that are different.
There
For
are.
Example, anticipation, claim construction, and the way in which the board handled the objective evidence. Otherwise,
okay.
the prior art is essentially the same.
Well, in that case, let's hear from the other side on the first appeal. Okay, Mr. Swick.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joe Swick. I'm here on behalf of the Appalese Gnosis in this case. I'd like to address some of the comments that my opposing counsel just made to the court. First point he talked about was the fact that this idea of the reasonable expectation of success. And I will concede that in the final written decisions, there is no specific express language talking about the reasonable expectation of success. Those words are not in the opinion. However, it's clear to us that the board did engage in that analysis, and that is evidence in the actual opinion itself. The way the board expressed its belief that there would be a reasonable expectation of success is that it talked about, and this is on page 837 of the record, that the serpentine reference calls for a suitable active metabolite of folate in an oral preparation. It uses those words. And then after looking at those words of what serpentine calls for, which is a suitable active metabolite, the board takes the next step and looks at the Meraza reference, which also relied upon, and says, that's it. Meraza is raising its hand. Meraza is saying, I am the suitable active metabolite. I am the 6S5MTHF.
But so, it isn't just that the L5 might be a suitable metabolite. As far as the reasonable expectation success, doesn't there also have to be a reason for selecting L5 to start with?
There does have to be a reason for selecting the L5 as well, and the Meraz reference absolutely did talk about that, and the board recognized the reason that one would pick the L5-MTHF among the suitable active metabolites. The Meraz reference talks about how the L5 is going to be useful for vitamin therapy as an active metabolite of folate. It then talks about the distinction between the L5, the 6S isomer, and how that is different than the 6R isomer.
Well, I'll tell you what troubles me in this, what looks like a hindsight. Here we have years, decades of an appreciation of the role in metabolism of this vitamin. And without this step, this selection, until these scientists came along.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's clear that the 6S L5 isomer was seen as the most promising isomer of the eight reduced folates that are in the metabolite cycle that happens with folic acid.
Well, the idea of selecting an isomer or selecting a metabolite seems to be something that was not particularly present other than perhaps as a scientific curiosity.
Well, Your Honor, I think Meraza really did solve the problem of figuring out which of the eight isomers would be believed to be the most useful. And Meraza is the one who says, you know, after he comes after serpentine, raises his hand and says, here it is, the 6S5M.
But how do you get from serpentine to Meraza? Mm-hmm. Even assuming Meraza discloses that, where's the board's analysis on the motivation to combine those two?
The motivation to combine and that was an argument that was not in the they did not raise that argument in this appeal, but they did raise that argument in the other appeal. And the motivation to combine, the board did find it in page 823 in the 1779 Merck appeal. And the board found that the close similarity of purpose and disclosure between these references, talking about serpentine Meraza, provides sufficient rationale for one ordinary skill in the art to have combined them. And it cites KSR. And before it gives that statement of law, it talks about how serpentine was there to correct folate deficiency and treat diseases associated with elevated levels of homocysteine. And then it recognizes that Meraza is disclosing the same purpose and disclosure by stating that Meraza specifically identifies a chirally pure L5-MTHF as an active metabolite of folate suitable for use as a therapeutic agent in folate-deficient states. And that's a quote from the board, and that's on page 823 in the 1779 appeal, when it's expressly addressing the motivation to combine. So that's for the motivation.
But this seems to be the board's own reasoning about why you combine. I mean, instead of actual evidence that some person of ordinary skill would have combined. Isn't there a distinction there?
Your Honor, I think the actual evidence is in the references themselves. I mean, is there a reference that says, you know, explicitly, did Meraza say, okay?
So is this more in your line, you think this is the board's conclusion that a person of ordinary skill looking at these two references would have found enough that they would have combined Serpentine and Meraza just based upon the closeness of the references?
Correct. And based on the similarity of the purposes of which they were both, you know, designated for and the actual disclosures within the references themselves. Counsel raised the issue of the Harpy references, and the primary argument they made with respect to the Harpy references is he talked about the effectiveness, but down below, what we were really talking about was whether Harpy disclosed whether the L5-MTHF or the 5-MTHF would be thought to be stable enough. And what the board correctly recognizes that, well, Harpy did express some concerns about stability in that time period, but then the board recognized that after Harpy came the Godfrey reference, came the Regev reference, came the Bettini reference, which all found that the 5-MTHF was suitable and stable enough to therapeutically treat. So the board correctly recognized that whatever concerns Harpy had in the beginning, those concerns had been overcome in the art prior to the invention through those three references. With respect to the Horn and Wagner-Uellen argument that counsel made, you know, that argument, you know, had a long factual basis. They first started their argument by saying, well, those references teach away because the L5-MTHF is a poor substrate for polyglutamation. Then we did the depositions, and the both experts said, well, actually, you know, folic acid is just as bad for the substrate activity for polyglutamation. And then we presented them with the Chikwetz reference, which showed folic acid was actually a worse substrate than the 6S5-MTHF. And therefore, we thought Wagner and Uellen could not be a teaching away. Then the argument morphed into, they said, well, what we're really seeing is it's the amount of the L5-MTHF that's retained in the cells. That's what's important. And the Wagner shows that there was really no accumulation of the L5-MTHF in the cells themselves. In the oral argument at the board confronted this and said, well, actually, Wagner does say that some L5-MTHF is within the cells. Isn't that correct? And that's what the board found. In fact, that's what Horn and Wagner do show. So then their argument really morphed into, well, okay, L5-MTHF is just as bad of a poor substrate. It is retained in the cells, but it's the amount of L5-MTHF in the cells that can be metabolized. And that's what Wagner shows. Well, and the board, you know, addressed that and said, no, that's not how we find on a factual basis. We find what Wagner's teaching is that some of the L5-MTHF is being metabolized, and Wagner is being conducted in an in vitro experimental type condition. There's no evidence in the record that that experimental result would translate into a similar result in vivo in the humans. So we're not going to accept that evidence as persuasive teaching away. And also they recognize that to the extent that Wagner and Horn say that the L5-MTHF is not significantly metabolized in the cells, metabolized was never defined by the Merck experts or the SAMHSA experts. So it's really just unpersuasive.
The metabolite was never defined. What do you mean?
The board made
metabolite?
A right. The
this word's in the dictionary, isn't it?
The word is in the dictionary, right? But the word, you know, has probably a very scientific meaning, and the problem is there was no scientific basis or expert opinion of what metabolized means in the context of what Horn and Wagner were talking about in an experimental condition.
Yeah,
with
maybe
certain
cells. Misread the record, but the whole thing is about metabolites and selection of metabolites,
right,
and how many metabolites and how many variations.
Right. And that's That's our contention, that it is one of the...
So where was the lack of definition? Will you define it? Can you define it?
I cannot, and that's the problem. There was not expert testimony of what metabolization means in the context of that experimental test.
You're saying that in this case, the word has a different meaning from the ordinary common meaning of metabolite? Is there any doubt when they say that there are 8 primary metabolites, what they're talking about?
There's no doubt as to what those 8 metabolites are in the folate cycle that is moving around.
Want to understand your argument.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, can you say
that? I want to understand the argument that you're making about metabolite not being defined.
Right. Well, I'm just recognizing that the board had struggled trying to define itself what metabolization meant in the context of one sentence that was cherry-picked out of the Horn and Wagner reference, and it asked counsel, I believe, at oral argument, that's my recollection, what does that mean? And no one was able to define it at the board's hearing. So if they're going to use this as a teaching away, they need to come forward and explain what it's mean. I don't think it's my duty to prove what their teaching away reference means and what the experimental result meant in a teaching away.
Counsel, I take it you handled this before the board?
Yes, co-counsel actually split it. Correct.
All 4 of the cases?
Correct, Your Honor. They were split into 2. We, similar to this one, we had 3 Bailey patents and 1 oral argument, and then we had the Merck patent, a separate oral argument, all on the same day in consecutive order too.
You never objected to the absence of definition of metabolite until now?
I don't recall, Your Honor. I really don't recall if I objected to that or not.
Your case doesn't turn on that issue, is that right?
It really does not turn on that issue at all. I mean, because this is one teaching away that they're saying, well, this would have dissuaded a person of ordinary skill in the art from ever using an L5-MTHF because of this experimental result. This is one experimental result. Contrast that to, we have serpentine saying, use a suitable active metabolite to lower homocysteine. We have Meraza saying, here I am. I am the suitable active metabolite. It's the best one out there. This is the one you want to use. We have Godfrey actually using 5-MTHF in experimental conditions and getting good results in treating depression. We have Rajiv, who's using an actual 5-MTHF product that's made by BioResearch in Milan, Italy, and he's using that. We have Patini, who's using it to treat bicyclists in the Alps Mountains who have sufficient or insufficient folate, and he's giving them iron and the 5-MTHF. So if in fact this one experimental result about there's a question as how well the L5-MTHF is retained in the cells and metabolized, why do we have this avalanche of evidence of all these other people actually using 5-MTHF? And we have Serpentine and Meraza all suggesting that this is the way to go. So it is one teaching.
They provided too much evidence?
Excuse me?
You're saying they provided too much evidence or not enough evidence?
Not enough. I mean, on this teaching away reference, this is, I think, just an anomaly, and it's undefined, it's inconclusive, it's unpersuasive. The board factually looked at this, and they came up with their substantial evidence in their mind of why this reference was simply just not a persuasive reference. Regarding the secondary factors, first of all, counsel suggested that the board took a strict test and said that, we're looking for what the novel element is in the claims, and it's a single novel element, and unless the commercial success or the secondary evidence is tied to that novel element, then we're going to reject it. First of all, they didn't ever reject any of the secondary evidence. What they said, the secondary evidence was tenuous at best. So it wasn't a wholesale rejection, as counsel has implied. But also, it's clear to me that the board did not limit its analysis to looking for only a single novel element as opposed to the claim as a whole. Because what we see on page A40 of the record, which is the page 40, the final written decision in the for the 915 patent, it says the particular combination of active ingredients in any of the PAMLAB products is not recited as an element or combination of elements of any claim under review. As such, the objective evidence for each product lacks a clear nexus with the claims. So here, it's clear to me that by saying that any element or combination of elements, the board is correctly considering the claimed invention as whole. It's looking if indeed there is any novel elements. It's not finding any. Counsel just told us that there are no specific novel elements. They say the claim is novel because its claim as a whole is what's novel, but here we see the board actually did consider the combination of elements as well and expressly said that it was looking at that as well. And, you know, counsel makes the point over and over again that, you know, well, they don't have to prove that every single embodiment within this very broad scope of claims is tied to the secondary evidence, and that's, it's never been our position, and it was not the board's position, that 100% of the embodiments within a specific claim needs to be attributed to the commercial success. But there has to be a nexus. There has to be a reasonable tie to the amount of products that fall within the claim and how they relate to the claims as a whole. Because here in this case, in the Bailey patents, we have very broad claims covering the 6S, 5-MTHF, and any combination of any vitamin, any mineral. So in my mind, the claims are as broad as a swimming pool, where every one of these embodiments is a specific marble within this swimming pool. And what SAMHSA did is says, all right, we got 5 or 6 SAMHSA products, and these are our 5, 6 marbles. We've made them. They have specific uses. They have specific vitamin combinations. And our 5 or 6 marbles, we're going to throw them into the swimming pool. That's the claim as a whole. And the swimming pool, so the fact that we can show 5 or 6 of these marbles within the entire swimming pool were successful, therefore that means the entire swimming pool is successful. And the objective evidence should be tied to this entire swimming pool full of marbles. And that's just illogical. It doesn't make sense. In this case, the board found it was a very, very small subset of embodiments that they presented on evidence as it relates to the claim as a whole. So for them to find that the secondary evidence was tenuous, I think there's substantial evidence in the record to support their finding on that.
Okay, I think that as far as, let's hear the rebuttal on the university's appeal, and then we'll proceed with the other case and the remaining issues.
All right, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors. With respect to the requirement that the board make a finding of reasonable expectation of success, let me just cite for the court's benefit. I'm sure I understand the court's aware of this case. Perfect Web, 587 F3rd 1324 1329, where there, citing to KSR, the court said, with respect to obviousness, to facilitate review, this analysis should be made explicit. So to the extent that Pelley was arguing that it was indirect, that the word suitable, which by the way is a claim limitation, I'm sorry, it's part of an entire phrase, suitable active metabolite of folate, that there was somehow a built-in reasonable expectation of success analysis into the term suitable, even then I don't think that would be considered to be an explicit analysis of reasonable expectation of success. In fact, the word suitable wasn't even really defined in this case. I mean, the board did not adopt any particular definition of the word suitable.
But our view was that it should be made explicit to facilitate review.
Correct.
Assuming we can review a matter without it being explicit, there's no error on that issue, is there?
To the extent that it was either an indirect or implicit, I'm not aware of a situation where that would be so, especially in a situation where you have a subject matter which is so complex. I mean, we were not on notice, I would say, in terms of what the basis was and what would be our recourse to that extent if we weren't even able to discern what the RES analysis was done, if it was done indirectly or implicitly. And you're going back and forth different pages. A couple of things. Now, with respect to with the Harpy references, Gnosis was they were the ones that raised Harpy to establish that it taught.
Yeah, but the problem with Harpy is, even if we agree with you that they teach away, there's a whole bunch of other references that the board relies on to say they don't. So on this very deferential substantial evidence review, it doesn't matter what Harpy says. It matters what the other ones say, doesn't it?
But there's two classes of references. The ones that they were just referring to, there's a whole slew of them that were not even addressed in the board's decision. No factual findings were made. For example, Godfrey. I'm sorry, not Godfrey. There are other references. I can't think of them right now, but there was a series of references that were not relied upon in the board's decision. So it's tough to now come forward and say, well, this reference teaches, you know, toward the invention. If you, for example, Godfrey, if you at the very end of Godfrey, he concludes. He has no idea why this works. He doesn't understand the mechanism of action. Doesn't understand if correcting folate deficiency.
But we're not the fact finder.
No,
all
actually not.
All we're
looking
at
That's right.
is whether there's substantial evidence. As long as we find one of those references that doesn't teach away, isn't that substantial evidence to support the board's conclusion?
Well, I mean, but then again, if we go back to Harpy, though, I mean, Harpy is live.
But that's the problem. We don't have to go back to Harpy. It doesn't matter what Harpy says as long as there's enough evidence to support the other conclusion.
Agreed. But now Harpy, in addition to the horn and everything else that we've laid out, would suggest that these other references do not say anything about lowering homocysteine. They don't tell you anything about the uptake of what's going on. We know that there's the uptake. But there's substantial evidence, but where is the reference that's teaching that if you administer L5 specifically, you're going to lower homocysteine? That is not in the record. There's no prior art teaching that. The references he cited do not teach that, and that would not be substantial evidence at all. And by the way, they don't offer a single expert to discuss those references, which also makes it a little bit more difficult because now it's just attorney argument that's being substituted in the place of evidence. This, with respect to the metabolism, that was not ever in dispute, the word metabolism. It was clear. I mean, the references, the horn references shows metabolism is the L5, it's radio labeled. I'm not sure where that came from, but that was not something that we were had a problem with or anyone had a problem with during the oral argument. And with respect to the secondary evidence, although not required, Gnosis did not provide or put forth an expert to rebut any of the experts in that respect. All they provided, in essence, is an attorney argument. They didn't address the market. They didn't have an expert addressing the market, an expert addressing the long-felt need, or an expert addressing the commercial sales and putting it in perspective. And so, then turning to substantial, this is not, in a sense, a case of substantial evidence. It really is primarily an application of the law by the board that was incorrect with respect to secondary considerations. That is the heart of what we're saying versus the facts itself.
Okay. Oh, can we proceed to the second case, or are there anything else you need to tell us in rebuttal in a sentence or two?
Yes, there is just one more point.
Okay, we have it.
Okay, we will.